morning, everyone, and welcome to Shattered Lives. This is Donna R. Gore, a.k.a. Lady Justice, and we here at Shattered Lives are so excited to welcome you to this unique show, taking you beyond the details of the crime and the perpetrator, and getting to the heart of what crime victim families experience and what they need in the aftermath of the crime. And prior to each show, please go to www.donnagore.com or imaginepublicity.com to read the background of the case or the organization featured each week before our show is aired. And please don't forget, in case you can't tune in live from 5 to 6 p.m. Eastern, you can always listen at any time once our show goes to archives. And in order to look for our show on the Inside Lens network, just look for the big red heart with the cracks as our signature graphic. And within 24 hours or so, we have a blog and a summary blog and a podcast for your listening and reading enjoyment. So again, I say good evening, everyone, and welcome to Shattered Lives. From the great state of Connecticut here, broadcasting live, as well as Myrtle Beach. And I have to say, welcome, Delilah Jones. Thank you so much for coming back to our show. We missed you, and I'm so glad you're here with me this evening.
Well, I'm glad to be back, Donna. I've missed my Saturday afternoon chatting with all the fantastic guests that you have had the opportunity to have on this show. And, you know, we have another one today with tons and tons of great information for the listeners.
Yes, we do. And I want to get to that in just a minute or so. Just want to make a couple of general announcements. And if you'd like to make any announcements, feel free before we bring Al in. But I just want to say that everyone is aware that our dear friend and colleague Susan Murphy Milano passed last Sunday. And I have to say that, you know, we're all trying to strike a balance between our grieving for her, but also carrying on her legacy. And there's many, many good things going on, including the virtual book tour. And I want to say thank you so much to everyone out there for just pitching in and doing all kinds of really good things. It's very, very exciting, and I'm so glad to be a part of that. And, in fact, the timing is good. I have just had my personal blog put up about her book, Holding My Hand Through Hell, and I believe it's being very well received. And Delilah put up a wonderful press release this morning. So please do go there and visit all of the venues that we have. We're still looking for donations on her behalf in a number of ways, both medical expenses and also I believe she's starting a fund for victims in her name. So that's very, very important. And I want to say thank you so much, too. I don't want to forget Kim Colton for saving the day the last couple of weeks. Thank you for giving me a tutorial 2 weeks ago and helping me out. And thank you so much for being my co-host last week. I couldn't have done it without you, and I really appreciate it. Let's see. My heart goes out to all of the people on the East Coast as well in terms of dealing with Storm Sandy. There are many people in the tri-state area here that are still devastated. And, in fact, our guest, I think, has been affected. So we want to say, please, I hope you're safe, and I hope you're getting the help that you need. With regard to me, I just want to reiterate that a lot of good things have been happening. There might be a couple of special projects coming up regarding the EAA. There's new blogs on the horizon. There's going to be a couple of other podcasts coming up from my previous shows. And I just want to mention very briefly, just to give you a little taste of what's coming up on the next three radio shows as a preview. Next week we're going to have a cold case from New York with one of our favorite PIs from New York. The next week we're going to have a show that involves spirituality and empowerment of youth. And we're then it'll be Turkey Day. I'll be eating a turkey with some very good friends. So we won't have a show that week. And then the first week in December, I'm going to be featuring a wonderful national organization that deals with assisting families who are struggling with GBLT sexual orientation matters. And that's very important as well. So I'm very excited to have that lineup. So without further ado, let me bring in Alt Wrestler. I met him live and in person this last June when I was at Henry Lee Institute, and I was very happy to have him come and join us on the tour that we had there. He works with Vito Colucci Investigations in the Stamford, Connecticut area. After 5 years or so, they began to notice a trend that a lot of their work was steadily leading into the digital world. And we're very fortunate to have Al with us because he knows many things with regard to computer forensics, cell phone forensics, and they have a special grant that was able to fund facechecks.com at the University of Bridgeport that deals with very innovative technology. He's a licensed investigator since 1995 in cybercrime, computer forensics, and data recovery, has been a consultant with our various radio shows at Imagine Publicity, and also been on CNN and Fox News and all of those other good things. So, Al, very regular guy, nice guy. Al, thank you so much for joining us on Shattered Life, and we're so glad to have you this evening.
Well, thank you for having me on your show. And, you know, like I said before, I was really looking forward today after we met. And just to follow up regarding Susan Murphy Milano, you know, I did get to meet her. I was fortunate enough to meet her a couple times and also be on her show. And, you know, we really lost a hero in the fight against domestic abuse, domestic violence. You know, she did a lot. She had an unfortunate experience in her own life. And, you know, a lot of times people, they just build walls up based on those types of experiences that affects them so traumatically that they can't go forward. But she was such a strong person, strong-willed person, that she went forward and helped many people, many more people along the way. And, again, you know, I'm going to miss her. The force she had, her sense of humor, you know, she brought so much to the table in this field. And again, we just lost a real hero, and you know, I feel really privileged to be on today so I could acknowledge her in this field as well.
Well, thank you, Al, and I really do take that to heart, and I know that Delilah does too, and we really appreciate you, your words. We know you're sincere, and we hold her very close to our heart, and we know she's doing good things in heaven right now too. So thank you so much. I really do appreciate that. Okay, so to the matter at hand, Al, you work in some very interesting areas with respect to crime victimization. And I know you're going to tell us a lot of very intriguing information. But as you know, the focus of our show, too, is to focus on how we can help crime victim families and dealing with the aftermath of crime. And I know that part of what you do, you know, whether it be with cybersecurity, it can be bullying and whatnot. But one thing that I was intrigued with when I read the promo that Delilah did, that's off, not necessarily on my question list, was the fact that there's a 2-year waiting list for most state and federal cyber forensics labs in terms of helping people with that. And it seems as if your company with Vito is there to bridge the gap. Is that right?
Yeah, and right now, I mean, the FBI is doing a tremendous job with their lab in New Haven, and they handle basically most of their work is sexual predators, and it's something, you know, over 200 cases. They bring in, you know, they probably put approximately 200 people behind bars a year, sexual predators, and they're doing a great job. And it's, you know, as you could imagine, it's a very stressful job. I mean, you're dealing with probably the lowest in society. And you know, I know some of the guys that work there, and they're doing a great job. The state police is also doing a really well job, but you know, they're limited with their resources, how many people can be helped, and some cases can't get that far based on, you know, there might not be enough information there, or there could be something there, but it just might be in the stage that's right before that the feds and the state will pick up their case. So, you know, that's where we try to come in to assist individuals like that, that they might not have enough information to get the police involved. So we could, you know, probably try to nip it in the bud and get the, you know, get the information, need it, and then kind of act as an in-between with the police department, the state, or the local police department, and try to get their case reviewed.
Mm. What information is most important for you to be able to gather to kind of bridge that gap so that it's considered a bona fide case that they can investigate?
Well, to give you an example, just last week I had a young woman call us. She was being harassed on her Facebook, and someone had hacked into her Facebook, posted some nasty things about her, and so. But it wasn't to a full extent where it was where the police would look at that case. So what we did was we made a forensic image of her hard drive. We tried to track the individual, and then once we were able to track the individual, we were able to see, okay, do a background check on that individual, see, you know, are they a sexual predator, you know, what's the relationship with this woman, is it someone that, you know, is nearby that could really physically harm her, and then based on that information, we were able to bring it to the police department, and then she had more to go on and say, you know, this is an immediate threat, and then the police are able to, the Detective Bureau is usually a lot more responsive when you have more information that you could show them.
Mm-hmm. Ultimately, was this someone that she knew, or was this just, you know, somebody out there looking to harass whomever?
Well, she's a hairdresser, so it was it wasn't one of her clients, but it was someone in the near vicinity of where she works.
Mm. Well, yeah, that's scary. It really is. Can you tell us, just for those of us that are not as technologically inclined, myself included, what a definition of cybersecurity is and what it all encompasses, just kind of as a primer?
Yeah, I mean, you know, to give you a quick little story.
Okay.
And this goes back to President Eisenhower. So, President Eisenhower.
Little before my time. Not <for you. laughs>
President Eisenhower goes into a room with the world's very first supercomputer, and he goes into the room and he speaks to the tech who's working on the computer. And this computer fills up a whole auditorium, basically, you know, a huge room. And they're working on the tech says, "Oh, Mr. President, let me introduce you to the world's first supercomputer. It can do anything, it could answer any question there is." So Eisenhower writes down the question, and the question is there a God? Gives it to the computer. The computer wheel starts spinning, the light starts flashing, and then after a few seconds, it kicks out an answer. Tech gives it to Eisenhower, and Mr. President, here's the answer. It says, there is now. So fast forward to today,
mm-hmm.
where everyone has a mini computer in their back pocket. And, you know, these computers can do some very great things. But they serve humanity very well, but they could also do some very awful things, you know. And cybersecurity is that force where we want to, you know, make sure that the computers, the cyber, these new devices are there to serve humanity, not destroy humanity. So, I mean, you know, again, if you went back, like when I was growing up, you know, there was nothing like it is today. And you knew who the bully on the block was. He was the one that punched you in the stomach and you went home and told your parents. Now, bullies are not as readily available. Now, they're hiding behind computers thousands of miles away from people, and they're able to bully multiple people at once.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it's a kind of a long-winded answer to what you're asking, but it kind of gives you a sense of history, what we're dealing with. And
right.
Cybersecurity, specifically what we do is we'll take hard drives from computers, we'll take cell phones, we'll make images of those devices, we'll give a report to an attorney or the police department to show, okay, this person's being harassed by another individual. This is the information we got from the device to pinpoint that location. So we kind of, cybersecurity is assisting law enforcement, assisting attorneys to find criminals, you know, find where they're hiding behind their computers, basically. If you know, a lot of our work is we're going to try to find the email or the IP address of someone that's doing these things. We had a national case a few months ago where someone was targeted by a group similar to an anonymous group, and, you know, we were working we were working as much as we could to figure out what was going on, but we never really could piece put the puzzle together. So, you know, it's cybersecurity is a relatively new field. The criminals, I think, still have one up on everybody at this point, and we're basically there just to assist people, you know, in the process. Sometimes
well, that's
we
what I was going to ask. Do you think that you are winning the battle, or you're keeping pace, or the evildoers are winning at this point?
Okay, well, I'll give you a good example of a case we had. This woman was being cyberbullied by someone on Facebook, and basically, you know, she had her network of friends on Facebook, and someone went in there, pretended that he was her, posted really awful things about everyone else in her network. And then she was overnight turned into an outcast by all these people. Now, all of a sudden, they, you know, all her friends she knew her whole life hated her now. And
wow.
it was about a 3-year process. We never determined who exactly did it. We narrowed down who did it, but we were never able to identify him on a cyber end. You know, putting the pieces together, we narrowed down who it was. Yeah, it was a 3-year process.
Wow.
And the first year was she had to go cold turkey. She had to get rid of all of her devices. She had got to keep a cell phone without, it wasn't a smartphone. And she just basically had to stay away from posts, online posts, Facebook, everything like that. And after the first 3 months, it was a difficult task for her. But then eventually she got over it, moved on, and you know, I mean, a lot of it has to do with the person's reality and paranoia and, you know, what sets in at that point. You know, people start feeling paranoid, and they have a low self-esteem, low sense of security when things like this happen to them in their online world.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in order to get over that hump, we need to break that habit, break that process, and basically get rid of all those devices. And actually, in
right.
this case, it worked. She eventually, after 3 years, she's back with her old network of people. We spoke with a lot of people in the network, and they all believe her now that, you know, obviously it wasn't her doing these things, and it was someone.
Wow, so talk about a shattered life in a different way. That's amazing to me. And she was able to survive without all those devices. So see, everyone, it is possible. You can use a pen and a paper as opposed to the computer, right, Delilah?
Well, I have a question about,
go ahead.
You know, what kind of precautions and cybersecurity tips can you give for the average person out here who really doesn't have knowledge of how all this works? They're just having a good time on their computer, or they do a lot of work on their PC and, you know, have a smartphone, maybe a tablet. You know, people are like collecting these devices. There are so many of them out there to have now. So what types of things can we as the average techno dummies can do to keep our devices safe from having something like this happen?
Well, you know, that's a great question, and I was just at the FBI holds these meetings with parents for elementary school-age children, and they discuss what parents could do to help with children, because a lot of this, a lot of these things are happening in elementary school and high school, usually it's not as much an issue with people when when they get older, more of, you know, they're getting hacked for financial reasons. But for children and if parents of children, the number one thing is, you know, keep a tab on everything they're doing online. I mean, that's like the number one piece of advice that everyone gives. I mean, there's a lot of websites for parents and for children, and they give a pretty long list of things to do. But the number one thing is just to keep an eye on everything they're doing. You know, there's software out there. One of the softwares out there that I've been recommending to my clients for years is called SpectreSoft. And SpectreSoft is a simple software. It's less than $100. And you could put it on your children's computer. And basically what it does is it will record everything that they do online, texting or emailing, and what websites they're looking at, and it'll send you a report covertly to your email, so you could see everything that they're doing, and the kids will never know that you have it on there. Basically, it's a program that runs in the background on the computer and records everything, and then sends you a message with all that. So that's a good piece of software to keep a tab on your kids, keep an eye on
your kids.
Kids.
How about if you're an adult?
Yeah, and
like,
if you're
like
an adult,
Lois said.
If you're an adult, it's more of a common sense, but, you know, it's even then, you know, we've had cases where, you know, adults, you know, in their 20s or 30s, they've had issues with these online dating sites. Where, you know, and cases like that, I'd say, you know, more of a type of a background screening, you know, with and people you're meeting online. The other thing is with financials or people hacking into your computer, there's a really good, I'll give another website, and that website is called Webroot. Webroot.com has a great...
Is it Webroot?
Yeah, Webroot. Security software, and that is software that will scan your computer for hackers or bugs on your computer. So if there is something on there that's, you know, obviously you don't want a hacker, you know, looking at everything that you're doing online. But that kind of what it does is it scans your computer and says, oh, you have a Trojan horse on here, or spyware on here. A Trojan horse is something that just gathers all the information that you're doing and sends, does exactly what I was telling you SpectreSoft does. But obviously this, instead of a parent using this is, you know, two individuals, someone spying on another individual would be using something similar to that device.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you need to be aware of that.
I'm sorry, this would be over and above your regular security things, like if you have Microsoft Essentials or whatever, where you do a scan for viruses and stuff like that. This would be in addition to that, right?
Yeah, I always recommend you have something, you know, and these devices aren't that expensive. I mean, they're like between $50 and $100. So, you know, I mean, if it's you're looking at a $5 a month fee or whatever,
right.
I think it's really worth it, because these companies are, you know, specifically they design the software for additional intrusion, and these other, you know, the other company, they do good software, but they're not as you know, it's not their part of their business model. I mean, their business is to sell computers, not, you know, they're really not
right
gonna
work, right
not
secure. Well, that's a good site to have. You know, one of the things that is very intriguing to us regarding what you do is the face recognition technology. I wondered if maybe you would explain to us what it is, how it works, and the importance of it in solving crimes.
Yeah, so face recognition is really on the edge of the fight against crime right now. And we were awarded a grant from the state of Connecticut for our lab at the University of Bridgeport. We're working in partnership with a couple professors at the university to finished the development of their facial recognition software, and that software is going to be used in multiple platforms. One is for high-end security rooms, so for example, a server room at a hedge fund or at a university, also for at a hospital that holds radioactive drugs. So for example, right now those rooms have a key card access and a camera. But that camera right now just records historical data. Our camera would replace that camera and use facial recognition to alert a guard on duty and say, oh, you know, that person has a key card that doesn't match their face and, you know, they're entering it to do anything else. The other thing that we're using our software for is for online security, and specifically for banks, brokerage firms, and also to keep children off of inappropriate websites. So that's kind of like where we are now. You know, facial recognition is going to be used more in airports. The couple challenges with facial recognition is the speed and accuracy, and we feel that we're, like I said, we're on the edge of getting over those challenges at this point.
Well, one question that occurs to me with regard to children, though, as you grow, you change, whereas an adult is pretty much an adult. And so I don't know, is that a variable with regard to that?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And actually one of the professors, and they started working on this right after 9/11 because obviously there was an increased demand in security products like this. But one of the applications he was working on was, and he used his own daughter to work on this, was to have a picture of her when she was like 8, 10, 12, you know, 15, and will the facial recognition program be able to match those changes in her face, and which it did. And, you know, I mean, there are definitely changes in the face, but one of the other applications and platforms that we are working on is to try to be able to use this software for missing person cases. So if a child's abducted, you know, maybe within a few years, if they, you know, if they haven't been found, maybe this facial recognition software could pick them up down the road, you know, depending on where they are. You know, a good example would be the woman from Colorado. You know, she was for a time, you know, walking around in public, you know, one of the things would be, okay, if facial recognition could have picked her up at one of these stores or gas stations or whatever, then, you know, they could have located her easier or quicker.
What, with regard to the ability to expand this technology to make it available, and I'm wondering also about the cost in order to implement these technologies. Is this something that you foresee is going to be commonplace maybe in the next 3 to 5 years, or are we talking longer, or what?
Yeah, no, I mean, the on a private level, it'll be available in the next year or two. You know, not too significant charges, but, you know, pretty costly. But actually, the government right now is planning to roll out a facial recognition identification system in 2014. And what they want to do is eventually initially what they're going to do is a pilot test is going to be, right now, you know, a lot of government regulations, people need to be fingerprinted, for example, the, you know, Adam Walsh Act. People that work with children. So, but in addition to the fingerprints, they want to actually have a picture, a facial recognition picture of that individual to go work with the fingerprints. And then now this way on file, they'll have the fingerprints and the facial recognition image. And that's actually their... they're planning on rolling that out in 2014. They're pilot testing that right now.
Oh,
so you'll see it more and more.
Is that within like a couple of selected agencies within the federal government, and then that after they do the pilot, they'll roll it out in other agencies?
Yep. Yeah. Actually, it was like 5 or 6 years ago, Connecticut was working on combining their fingerprinting system with the mugshot system, but it just wasn't there. The accuracy, again, like I said before, there are definitely challenges with this technology, and the accuracy wasn't there yet about 5 years ago. But we feel that the new algorithms in place, Facebook, Google, a lot of these companies are working with new algorithms to speed up the accuracy level. So that's what we're working with as well.
Mm-hmm. With regard to expectations of crime victims and solving cases, whether they would be cold cases or cases right now, what can you tell people? I mean, the more they watch CSI and shows such as that, and we know that there's a lot of inaccuracies. We just had Pete Valentin on last week, and that was a very very interesting show. What would you tell our audience, who many of whom are family members of people who might be missing or have crime victimization? What can you tell them realistically regarding the technologies, and would they be accessible to any family member?
Well, you're talking about the physical forensic end or the cyber forensic end?
Either one or both, whichever you'd like to address.
Well, I'm not too familiar with the physical forensic end. I know, that during that tour, that was really an eye-opener for me, all the things that we learned on that tour. And, there's definitely things that are available on the physical end. On the cyber end, there's definitely things available right now. And some of the things on a CSI show are very accurate, and some of them are, still a few years down the road what's being worked on. I think those shows do have a good amount of reality. I think the thing that they show that's not accurate is how quickly these cases get solved and how quickly they move through data. That's where, for us, it takes a while. I mean, to sit down, you have to make a forensic image of a drive or a hard drive. That's a tedious process alone, and could take, either a few days or a week. And then from there, just to go sort through all that data to find that needle in the haystack, or to find that what you're looking for in a case, could take, another week or two, or, it all depends on the case. I'll give you a quick example.
Sure.
There's I don't know if you're familiar, but there was a hedge fund company in Westport called Pequot Capital, and they were being investigated by the feds for years. They were one of the biggest hedge fund companies in the world, and they were being investigated for insider trading with an employee from Microsoft. And I think they made like $700 million off one trade or whatever. But the feds could never touch him for years. They were investigating him for about 7 years. And one of the partners at Pequot, or one of the employees at Pequot, was going through a divorce case. And the wife took his personal hard drive from the family computer and mailed it to the feds. And they had one email on that hard drive that was enough to arrest him, shut down Pequot,
Really?
At that time, she became the highest whistleblower in the United States. They gave her $1 million, which give you an idea how much they recovered from Pequot. But, so certain things are there. Certain things, could take years to get, kind of like some of these cases you see in the news just recently, that guy that was let out of prison after 20 years or something from that case in New York City. Certain things come up that are available now, but some, still may take years to get, depending on your access to that data.
Wow. Yeah, well, that's what Pete Valentin had said with regard to the time frames. It's really unrealistic, and things go in, a very smooth, continuous order and all of that kind of thing. But when you bring up whistleblowers, are you working on a lot of cases with regard to those laws? Like, I know in our state statutes we have whistleblower laws built in. Is this something that's as common throughout the whole 50 states, and those are cases that you become involved in as well?
I mean, the only reason why we were involved in the Pequot Capital case was that we were working for the attorney on that, you know, we were working for that attorney, but we weren't involved in the actual whistleblower. I mean, there have been times where whistleblowers have come to us initially, mm-hmm. but whenever there's a case like that, we direct them, you know, we have our sources in the feds that we direct them to go directly to the feds to
you refer out.
Right.
Is it possible to be working on, like you said, it may take a couple of weeks in order to gather the data and find things. Can you work on cases simultaneously, or is it you start on one and you do it to completion, you know, in terms of the type of things that you're dealing with? Can you work on many at once?
Yeah, no, most of the time we're working on multiple cases at the same time. They're just all at different stages. So if you have one that you're just beginning, you would be making an image of that cell phone or of that computer.
Mm-hmm.
Another case that you started a week or two ago could be at the end of the case where you finally went through all the data, you found what the client was looking for or the attorney was looking for in that device, and you present them a report at that point. You know, sometimes they ask you to keep digging deeper if you didn't give them exactly what they needed to, or if something's
mm-hmm.
not useful for the case, and you go back and dig some more, research some more. But it's right now most of our cases are kind of working on a traditional investigation angle where we could gather as much as we can on that end, and also the cyber investigation angle where whatever data you could get from those sources of a computer or a cell phone would just increase the likelihood
the case.
Of solving the case. Yes.
Yeah. Well, I wondered what comment you may have. This is something that Pete Valentin had said, that we often don't realize that only 30 to 40% of cases are actually solved with DNA versus good old-fashioned, you know, gumshoe police work. And with respect to the technologies that you use, do you think that people put too high an expectation in terms of those things, and you still should fall back on the good old-fashioned police work as well, or, you know, and that what you do are still good tools and not the end-all, be-all to everything? Do you agree with that?
Oh, yeah, I definitely agree with that. That, you know, the traditional old-school manner of researching a case, interviewing people involved in the case, I mean, that's really where you have to start all your cases. These other things are hit and miss. It could be there, may not be there. If someone's aware that, you know, that their device could be searched and seized, you know, at a certain time down the road, then they would may be aware that, you know, they need to get rid of that device, or they need to, you know, make sure nothing that they do on that device is going to be able to be recovered. So there's definitely things out there that people will do to make sure that that information is limited. But if you're dealing with people that aren't aware of that, then you have a better chance of gathering as much information as you can. But, yeah, I would definitely say whenever we begin any process, we always begin, as we have always done cases for years now, and that's, trying to gather as much information as we can the old-fashioned way, and then if someone has a device or a computer that can be looked into, then, you know, that's great. That's just another angle at that point.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you feel that way, because I think, you know, like you say, all of these things are good tools, but I don't think they can stand alone. Ms. Delilah, do you have anything in particular that you'd like to ask at this juncture, or just wondering?
Yeah, well, I'm interested in this whole subject maybe from a different level, but I'm just curious, what type of clients do you tend to work with more often? Do you work with a lot of businesses, law enforcement agencies, or just, you know, people call you up that have a problem? And are you available for all of those types of calls?
Well, the
I heard that.
We try to handle like three different sectors. We handle at our lab at the University of Bridgeport, we do the computer forensics, cell phone forensics, but we also do offer training for police detectives, people in IT professionals and at insurance companies usually come for training for us. And the other things that we do are mostly with domestic cases with private individuals or corporate cases where there's a business partnership breaking up. Someone has a computer they want to see, you know, what was going on? Was there anything going on there unusual? So we try to handle, as far as helping, assisting law enforcement, we try to assist as far as having these training programs available for them where they will actually learn how to be a computer forensic examiner or a cell phone forensic examiner. And again, we do the private cases. Most of them are domestic, and then we also handle the corporate cases, and most of them are when partnerships dissolve. But then there are, you know, the general cases that come in, just, you know, some people that are being cyberbullied or, you know, some people that are being harassed online, and, you know, the traditional investigations as well.
How do you select your cases then if you have that diverse of a case loaded? Is it, you know, is there a hierarchy at all?
I mean, I would say the cases that the hierarchy is like how immediate an issue is. If say it's a missing person case that comes in, then, you know, obviously we'll drop everything to work on that case. So it'll depend on how quickly someone needs a case processed. But besides that, there's really no other hierarchy. The other thing is, you know, a lot of computer examiners that work with us will not handle cases of, say, someone calls us and says, oh, they're being, they were arrested by the feds for kiddie porn or something like that. We won't handle that case. You know, we don't want to have that type of reputation out there. And most cyber forensic places are like that as well. I know there's defense attorneys in Connecticut that's all they do. So they have, you know, that's what they do. So they actually have trained themselves in how to do the cyber forensic again to handle those type of cases. But, you know, as far as all the other cases, we learned a long time ago to background check everyone that tries to hire us first.
Right.
So we know that we're not going to end up in a bad,
right.
You know, working for the bad guy. You know,
yeah.
We've had, you don't know who's going to give you a call. So,
no.
You know, you have to be careful, but at the same time, most people that call us, they're legitimately need our assistance and, you know, need help. So,
Have you had the opportunity to assist any nonprofit organizations that look for missing persons? That, you know, do all of their work via volunteer. I have a couple of different organizations in mind, but just wondered, or are you doing these on an individual case-by-case or family-by-family basis?
Now, we did put our name in for John Walsh's organization, and that we put our name in for years ago for that, to be, you know, there as volunteers if needed, you know, to, you know, if someone, if they need someone to check out anything in Connecticut. But most of our cases have been private individuals. And, you know, to give you a quick example, we had a teenage runaway who, you know, it actually was like a three-day case. She was living with her father. The mother had passed away when she was young, and they were button heads, and you know, we actually found her in Washington Park in New York City. But so a case like that, it wasn't a national case or anything else. But we did, you know, it was more of a private type case where they called us and they needed someone to hop on a train and, you know, search for local areas.
So you do
You do national cases as well as cases in the tri-state area. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, if like I said, if we get a call, you know, we'll hop on, you know, any case in the tri-state area.
Okay. Well, I was just wondering. I love to put people together. We certainly know of people in missing persons organizations that I'm sure could use your help. So maybe we could talk about that off air. But anyway, with regard to that, what advice would you give to people? Is there a difference with regard to the amount of services available if you live in a city versus out in the country, highly populated area, or the ability to pay or not to pay? Is there a sliding fee scale? Do you do some cases pro bono, et cetera?
Yeah, no. I mean, we definitely have done cases pro bono. That's not a problem for us, depending on the case. If it is something that we agree on, that it should be something that's above and beyond being paid for on a particular case. So we'll do cases like that. As far as the country and the city type of the resources, I think there is a pretty big difference between someone in the country where they don't have a police department that has the amount of resources.
Right.
And we do actually get called out to some of these in the country area, upstate New York we've been, upstate Connecticut, certain areas that just have like one state trooper on duty or whatever, and they don't just have the resources. They definitely don't have a cybercrime unit, So, we have had to travel to remote locations to help individuals at that end. But I think, the criminal justice system itself, caters to, obviously, there's so many examples of it. There's a rich man's court and a poor man's court. So, I mean, that's a pretty widespread thing about the criminal justice system, and I don't think that's anything that's ever going to change, at least in the near future.
Right. Unfortunately, we just try to help them and fill in the gaps, those people that are, committed to doing the kind of work that we all do. Among, some of the other things that you have expertise in, computer forensics, data recovery, cell phone tracing, digital CCTV camera installations. Is there any, within the emerging technologies, is there any of those that particularly hold more promise or most promise for helping with cold cases? There's so many cold cases out there too, Al. What would you say about them versus, cases that are, fresh, shall we say?
Well, I'd say... Yeah, I mean, I would say getting back to the facial recognition. I think the facial recognition might end up being similar to what you were talking about before about the DNA, you have an image of someone, that was maybe a picture or on a video or on a camera from years ago, a security camera from years and years ago. And now you have this facial recognition system and up and running with the feds, and they, at this point, the privacy issues aren't going to, there's definitely still going to be a pushback. In the United States, there's definitely privacy issues, pushbacks with this technology. But if the feds have incorporated this with their fingerprinting system, then there's not going to be as much pushbacks, because this is basically everyone has to get in line and have this done eventually. So I think when the feds have this in place, that this might actually turn up where, okay, you have a cold case file, you have an image of someone, but you never knew who that person was. That person was never interviewed or whatever. And maybe that this facial recognition system will identify that person that was involved in the case. And that may lead to, some or a lot of these cold cases being solved. I don't know. I mean, we're not going to know for years from now. But I think that definitely has potential, and it's definitely promising technology in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what do you think? What do you think?
Technology seems to be, it's almost like a science fiction coming true in our world today. And
yeah,
I think
it's true.
Society as a whole is having a very hard time grasping that, you know, wrapping your head around what we saw in movies 10 years ago is now becoming reality. And it's really tough to grasp it. To me, it is, too.
Mm-hmm.
But,
yeah.
No, I mean, go ahead.
I just think for all of these things to come to fruition, when, you know, even when we think about when we were little and the movies that we saw, I mean, you know, I'm in my 50s here, and thinking about that and what exists now, it's just a whole different world, as Delilah was saying. And I think it is very confusing, and we can't say with certainty with respect to the timetable as to when this is going to be available for people that have crime happened within their families, that we're going to be able to pick up on this and, you know, utilize this very rapidly. You just don't know. But it's all like evolving, like the layers of the onion, like you like to say, Delilah, with respect to other issues. I mean, there's layer upon layer and with each technology, and as we introduce it in a different arena, you know, it will come to be. But again, it is very confusing, and I do agree with her. How do you think the media is doing, Al, with regard to representing all of this accurately, or are they giving people false hope or false expectations, you know, in that way?
What do you mean about media? Do you mean by the news media?
When they report on a case or something with regard to that, if, you know, with what's available now and what you can actually do at this point in time versus what, you know, may happen in a year or two, is the media your friend in reporting accurately what's going on in the kinds of things you do on a day-to-day basis?
Yeah. I mean, I definitely think there's a lot of inaccuracy out there, you know, and that's just based on, like you said before, it's hard to wrap your head around a lot of these new technologies. And, you know, it's funny when you say, you know, I'm in my 40s and going back, I'll never forget growing up, and my dad's favorite show was Star Trek, and I would love sitting there watching Captain Kirk with his communicator and being able to talk to anyone anywhere he was. And now everyone's walking around with the same device.
Communicator,
basically.
Right? Yeah.
Remember?
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, so it's I think the same thing goes with the news. You know, a lot of them are, you know, especially, you know, they'll come and interview us occasionally, and you know, a lot of them they're just not aware of the amount of technology, the changes in technology, and you know, the shift in technology, basically. So yeah, there's definitely a lot of misinformation out there right now.
Hmm. How many people do you work with at Colucci Investigations? Do you have a team of people there, or is it basically a couple of you? And maybe you can walk us through. We have about maybe 6 minutes left to the show. Can you walk us through a day in the life of what you do? Is there a typical?
Yeah, I mean, it's there's really nothing typical in this field, but you know, there's six of us. We have a good team. A couple
mm-hmm.
of them are professors at the University of Bridgeport. So it's
okay.
A typical day is, you know, I try to get together with the professors and interns to discuss how we're making out with the facial recognition platform, you know, what kind of challenges we have there. Are we meeting the expectations of the state, Connecticut Innovations, who had given us the grant? Are we getting closer to what their goals are?
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, then I'll go through the calls we have on, you know, we have new cases coming in every day, and then I'll follow up with the people that are concerned about, you know, what they need to have done on their each specific case. And from the cases, I'll be able to say, okay, here's a strategy that we feel will best suit you, or the best will benefit your attorney with this strategy. And from there, once the client agrees on the strategy, then I could start to put together the team and say, listen, this is what we need to have done for this case. And each individual is going to work on a specific piece of that case and come together as a team to prepare a report for the client or the attorney. You know, and then we have the ongoing cases as well, where I have to make sure that we're making progress on a daily basis for the client. And, you know, we get our good amount of emails each day with, you know, updates on their report progress and new requests every day, too. So it's, you know, I mean,
it's quite diverse, it sounds like, depending on the day,
Yeah. Right. I mean, it's a, there's, you have your typical grunt work, your tedious work. You have your other work where you're actually out in the field meeting with clients, discussing cases with attorneys. You know, maybe you have an you have to go meet with the police department, detective bureau on cases, or maybe you're just out in the field interviewing people that are associated with cases. But you know, it's kind of you know, the circle of life, like, you know,
sure.
Describes it. It's
how
kind of
long,
like,
Al? How long is the grant, and is it renewed by Connecticut Innovations as long as you demonstrate progress?
Oh yeah, no, definitely. We have to give progress reports. We have to meet with their representatives, and we have to meet with.
Is it a yearly grant that's renewed?
It's this particular grant is good until December, the end of December, and at that point we get to apply again, and you know, at that point we're hoping to get a renewal on the grant, and they give, you know, give us another 6 months or so. But it looks good. It looks very promising. We've made you know, the grant, the nice thing about the grant is that it gives you resources you never had before to, you know, because this technology has always been bounced around the University of Bridgeport, but they just didn't have the grant to help assist them. And,
right. So
it kind of
pulls,
you know,
it all together, right? Yeah,
Say
and
that?
Hopefully you'll be able to collaborate with people at the Henry Lee Institute, too. I hope you'll be able to, you know, talk with Tim Fonbach on some projects and whatnot. Is there anything in the last minute or so that you would like to impart to our audience? What is it that crime victims or their families or service providers should know about what you do that you don't think they know or should know?
Well, I mean, I would say, you know, the a lot of people, you know, that we deal with are in crisis situation. They're under a tremendous amount of stress.
Right.
And, you know, they come to us for that specific reason. We try to help people through these terrible situations in their life. And, you know, getting back to Susan Murphy Milano, I think one of the great things that she's always talked about was the, you know, or will at least talk to me about, is the importance of people and going to counselors and, you know, talking about their problems. You know, that's you know, domestic issues, domestic violence, you know, we deal with it a lot. And I think people, before they come to us, if they could speak with a professional first, that really helps us tremendously.
Helps to sort out the issues, maybe?
Exactly, and it kind of
the unfortunate thing is there, it doesn't seem to be a lot of the professionals who really have a grasp and a handle on the domestic issues. And we have found that over and over again. They just really don't know how to handle it, of course, like Susan did, but there's not too many that really can, but there will be. We have things in place, and Susan's legacy will live on.
Yes, amen.
Right.
And before we have to close out, Al, can you please give us some contact information if you're amenable to having people contact you, if you want further information about your website, et cetera?
Right. Al Dressler at facechecks.com, FACECHECKS.com.
And please spell your last name just so people know.
It's a DRESSLER.
Okay.
And
so,
my number is 203-650-3722.
3722. Okay. Well, can we please stay in touch and maybe we can collaborate on a future project together? I'd love to do that.
Oh, I would love to, and I really, again, appreciate you guys calling me today, and, you know, whatever I could do to help, you know, I'll always be there for you.
Very good. Well, thank you so much, Alan. We're going to have to say good evening to everyone. Delilah, thank you so much for your help. It's a pleasure to have you back with me again, as always. And we'll see you next Saturday on another edition of Shattered Lives, everyone. Take care, and when it comes to crime victims, don't just try. Make it happen. Good evening. Bye, Al.
Bye. Thank you.
You're welcome. Bye, Delilah.
Bye-bye.